American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Bull City, Durham, USA. This is Due South on listener-supported WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It's the end of the work week, so we're gathering for our requisite North Carolina Friday News Roundup. Panelists in a moment, but first, the montage.
I'm not opposed to us looking at salaries for teachers and state employees.
Republican legislative leaders are promising to give away hundreds of millions more just to make sure that the wealthier North Carolinians can pick up their government checks for children that they already have in private school.
Our mission is clear. We have to defeat Mark Robinson and his anti-abortion allies in the legislature this November in order to protect access for North Carolinians and for people across the South.
Well, a federal judge strikes down a state law criminalizing voting for people with felony convictions.
That law originally passed in 1877, and it made it a Class 1 felony for people who vote in North Carolina without having their voting rights restored.
And it's 4-3, Carolina! What a comeback! Yeah! The roof's about to blow off the building.
A smattering of the stories we hope to touch on this hour. Roof likely to stay intact here in Durham. As we check in on the North Carolina news landscape, here to help us unpack it all are Don Vaughn, Capitol Bureau Chief at the News and Observer, Gary Robertson, State House Reporter, Associated Press, Mary Helen Moore. She covers Durham for the News and Observer, and Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief right here at WUNC. Welcome in, y'all.
Morning, Jeff. Thanks,
hey, how you doing?
All right, let's pinwheel things to start. Biggest story of the week from your perspective, and why, Don?
The budget, the state budget. I'm not the only person that's excited about budget.
Your enthusiasm is real.
Yeah. Well, it's all our money that we're paying taxes for. We paid taxes on, the past few weeks ago and how to spend everything. And usually budget time doesn't get rolling until once the session's, underway. But Democratic Governor Roy Cooper said, I want to talk about the budget an hour before you start. And so that's really what ended up kicking things off. He told reporters what he wanted, released the budget after the news conference, mm-hmm. His proposal again. And, Republicans have a supermajority, so they can listen to him if they want or not listen to him if they don't want.
Or not. They can ignore him entirely. But he clearly, as he's done before, as governors all over the country do, he has put himself into the conversation because he wants certain things to be considered and discussed, if not at the very least talked about by folks like us and so on and so forth.
Yeah. They do. They do listen. Even, Senate Leader Phil Berger does listen to Governor Cooper. Not everything he says, but what the governor did was basically use reporters to go ask lawmakers, what do you think about it? Because they hadn't even looked at it yet. And we're like, oh, here's the gist. What do you think about it? That was what we did in the, Berger gaggle after session.
And set up sort of the big touch points in this debate between Democrats and Republicans over the budget. I mean, we're going to be hearing time and again throughout this process about education. What are the priorities? Is it expanding the private school voucher program to higher income families with additional potentially up to $300 million? Is it teacher raises? Is it other education funding? The governor, by sort of firing the opening salvo in this debate, sort of sets the tone for a lot of what we're going to be talking about and seeing the parties debating for, the weeks and months to come as this budget comes together.
And ho-hum, there is a fiscal cliff looming with federal money evaporating for child care centers. We're going to get, I think, second level on a lot of this stuff. Just moving forward real quick, and you can build on if you want. But, Gary, biggest story of the week from you and why?
Oh, well, it has to be the legislature coming back at the same time with the governor. And, it kind of has a first day of school feeling when they return. Didn't get a whole lot done during the week, but I think that's going to pick up next week. But it's just going to be interesting to see whether Republicans are willing at all, which is probably highly unlikely, to basically detour or derail two of the major policy initiatives they've had over the last decade, which is the Opportunity Scholarship Program and just the ratcheting down of the individual and corporate income tax rates. I don't see them really listening to the governor, but it's going to be a part of the discussion that's going to head all the way to the November election.
Opportunity scholarships, a.k.a. private school vouchers.
Yes.
Use them interchangeably. Mary Helen Moore, something that jumped out to you or was top most notable from this week?
Okay, with all due respect to the budget, for me, it's got to be the Carolina Hurricanes. They're having a lot of fun. They're playing with momentum, and if you haven't tuned in yet this season, now is the time.
The governor seemed more excited about the Canes than anything about the budget during his budget press conference.
I don't know if you even need the word seemed, right? Like, having talked to the governor many times, as you all have, I think the governor is legitimately more excited about the Hurricanes than a lot of these battles that they've been fighting for years. Colin, briefly, just 30 seconds or so, top story of the week for you.
I think one of the big things for me was the Planned Parenthood funding for the governor's race. They want to put in $10 million, double what they've done in the past, apparently unprecedented for state spending on them, because abortion is going to be such a key issue between Mark Robinson and Josh Stein in this governor's race. They're putting some serious juice behind it and trying to raise the issue and make that, you know, abortion is on the ballot is the line that they're going with. And they're right. I mean, there's a very key contrast between these two candidates on this issue and how restrictive we go. And you're seeing that play out in the money race.
The faucet of money is open in the gubernatorial race. It is flowing and it will not stop for the rest of the year now. We're off and running on our North Carolina news and politics roundup here on Due South. Still ahead this hour, Durham restaurant survival. Could cannabis clear conservative hurdles? And those Canes, we'll chat a little bit more about them. They are back in the playoffs. They erased an 0-3 deficit the way a Zamboni clears off choppy ice on Tuesday night. The North Carolina Friday News Roundup rolls on in a moment here on listener-supported WUNC. Welcome back. It's Due South on WUNC. It has been 159 years since Union General William Tecumseh Sherman and Confederate General Joseph Johnston finalized a surrender of North Carolina, this during the Civil War. The military leaders worked out the details of that pact on the farm of James and Nancy Bennett near Durham Station. The Civil War officially ended in North Carolina on this day in 1865. We're with Colin Campbell, Don Vaughn, Gary Robertson, and Mary Helen Moore for our North Carolina News and Politics Roundup here on Due South. We're going to return our attention to the legislature. I want to build on something we were talking about a few moments ago, which is education funding. There is the raises push, there's the vouchers push, and there is this question of federal funding now evaporating or drying up as it pertains to child care centers. Anyone care to prioritize these three?
I think it's important to note that people knew this money was not forever, that it wasn't recurring, that it was COVID funds. So that none of this is a surprise.
Sure.
So that's something that everyone knew was coming. You could do things to mitigate it if you wanted to. But the response of the legislature is they're going to still like find a way to mitigate it. But I think what's going to happen is going to fall along the same partisan priorities that the Republicans, like the private school voucher scholarship, so they're going to fund those. The child care is an actual serious issue. Representative Jason Sain was talking to reporters on Wednesday, and he said, yeah, this is a reality for everyone. And it's not just that person's family and their child care needs. It also impacts the workforce significantly. So that's also a business thing. So that's why I think it's a nonpartisan issue that people need to solve.
Go ahead, Gary.
I'll just say, and the governor's budget had basically $750 million for various child care and pre-K and to deal with some of this so-called fiscal cliff, along with a new tax credit for child care. From what I've talked to the Republicans on, they obviously see this as an issue, but it's not going to be particularly, you know, that they're going to just reimburse all these child care providers for what they would have gotten already. I think they're trying to find some solution that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to just throw out cash at the problem. I talked to the majority leader in the Senate, Paul Newton. He's looking for some ways, maybe some more innovative ways, maybe helping with property tax deferrals, more things to do with, you know, with private companies. So I don't think the solution is necessarily just throwing cash at the issue completely.
And there's just generally speaking, there are a few issues that I can think of. Maybe one of you can think of something. The state can't typically match or compensate for federal funds. Like, there are just so many, there's so much more in the way of federal funds typically, especially when these kind of programs roll out. Like, okay, the federal program is ending. The state doesn't have the kind of money to put in, and to your point, Don, in perpetuity, what the Fed had, or the
we have to have a balanced budget here, unlike the
right.
federal government. So that puts a lot more constraints on what right. can and cannot be done at the state
right.
level.
Very well said. Well, I'm going to keep going with the legislature in a moment, but Mary Helen Moore, this issue of federal funds ending, talk to us a little bit about small businesses and how it has how it has impacted them. This is something you've been tracking, restaurants and other development.
Well, I cover all the local governments in Durham, and the issue of federal funds running out is something they're all wrestling with kind of for the first time this year. I mean, it's the city, it's the county, and it's also the schools. So the schools are an interesting case. They used this federal ESSER money, they call it, to fund not only like repairs and maintenance of schools, but also certain positions. And so it's an open question what's going to happen to those positions, things like mental health counselors at schools, which everyone agrees was really important during the pandemic. That doesn't mean they're not still important. So pandemic recovery, man, it's still going on. And I went to another event this week about downtown's recovery, which has been interesting. And we talked about some of the restaurants that have managed to hang on throughout all of that. And so, yeah.
We're going to talk about a little later in the program some of the restaurants that have been here the longest in downtown Durham, where we sit as we record our Friday news roundup on Due South. We're going to spend plenty of time in the next couple months chatting about the budget. I do suspect this is a process that will play out between now and late June, early to mid July.
Let's just say July.
Early summer.
Yeah. Early summer.
Early summer.
I want to spend a couple of moments on medical marijuana. This is something that has been in the legislative ethos for a couple of sessions now. Colin, where do things stand?
So we are waiting to see if the House does anything with this. I'm not seeing any signaling that they are super eager to take up medical marijuana. But one interesting thing that Senator Phil Berger said this week was that he seemed to think there was the possibility of some sort of cannabis-related compromise. The House has passed new regulations for CBD and hemp products. That's a story that I've been working on for a while. Should be out soon. But the Senate has gone with medical marijuana. And if you put those two together, you give the House the regulations they want to keep some of these existing products out of the hands of teenagers. At the same time, you allow medical marijuana for the most ill people who need it the most as part of their medical treatment. That could maybe be a happy medium that gets across the finish line. But whether the House would go for that kind of a compromise, I don't know. We've had any indication yet.
As a reminder, the proposals that we've seen in recent years have been pretty narrow as we think about what would be legalized relative to what could be legalized or what has been legalized in other states. And one other point I just want to drop here, and Gary, build on it or go in a completely different direction, but the lead proponent of medical marijuana is a state senator by the name of Bill Rabin. He is one of the handful of most powerful people at the state legislature. And I think this whole issue bespeaks a couple of things. One, really how conservative many lawmakers are, truly still conservative on social issues. That's unsurprising to a degree. But also the power of rank and file lawmakers. This is one of the more powerful members of the legislature. He's been openly talking about this and pushing this for years. And they haven't been able to get it all the way through.
Well, as my colleagues know, he has a Senator Rabin had a personal experience where he had a cancer diagnosis, and somehow, I mean, he mentioned this publicly in a committee, I believe, last year that he had received and used marijuana for medicinal purposes to help him deal with the pain and the nausea and such, and it was a very compelling argument that, you know, certainly got it over the Senate finish line. But in the House, it just hasn't. There's just still some people there who just equate any sort of marijuana use with a social ill that should not be authenticated or implemented in North Carolina. And so it seems as though that that maybe some kind of exchange like what Colin mentioned could be the way to get this across the finish line. Obviously, in the broader culture, this, though, is much more accepted than it was, you know, even 5 years ago.
One other thing that's changed on this issue, just within the last, I think, week, is that the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians have now opened a cannabis dispensary up in their corner of the state, aptly named the Great Smoky Cannabis Company, which is a great play on words for the mountain range up there. I think, if I'm understanding it correctly, the sales are fairly limited. Like, you can't just go up on your summer trip to the mountains and come back with a carload of weed. You need to be an enrolled member of the Cherokee or something of that nature. But I think certainly that increases the available supply in North Carolina, even if it is somewhat controlled as to who can actually go up there and buy it.
Well, if you think about, is there money to be made off of this? You know, like, right, there's regulation, obviously, but then, like, what are the tax possibilities? What are the business possibilities? And when you see that, you know, down in the Cherokee region, and like the same thing with sports gambling, this is happening anyway, we should regulate it and make money off of it. And I think that's going to be like the incremental move.
Let me build on that point a little bit. And I want to hear y'all on this thought that I had. And it's not really necessarily a well-formulated thought, but we think about sports gambling, think about casinos, and we think about marijuana. And our neighbor to the north has moved forward more quickly, is ahead of North Carolina on these things. So I wonder if Virginia, if a dispensary opens in Virginia, and it would appear that's going to happen before a medical, or not a medical, a marijuana dispensary, if that opens just north of the state border, do you think that kind of business opportunity would move some lawmakers?
Well, I talked to a Virginia State House reporter, like, I don't know, several months ago, about how Virginia, with the marijuana law, they didn't have enough structure in place, and it kind of ends up being a mess. So North Carolina has lessons to learn. They're right there across the border of what you want to do. But the border thing is interesting, especially since the person that controls the Senate and, you know, largely the state lives close to the North Carolina-Virginia border.
And he's been envious of that Danville casino for the past year.
Exactly. So,
Bill Berger, Republican, Rockingham County.
I mean, this is a history that we've seen for decades, where North Carolina always has been looking at Virginia on the lottery. There were convenience stores along the border that were selling lottery tickets. There were lines out the parking lot, you know, when there were big jackpots. The same happened last year with casinos, although it didn't cross the finish line. We're going to probably see the same thing if medical marijuana dispensaries open up closer to the North Carolina border.
Is there an example of where you can flip the script, where North Carolina led the way on something and Virginia said, oh, that's a pretty good idea, old North State?
I mean, our beaches are better. I lived in Virginia for a really long time. I think it's fair to say the North Carolina beaches are better. Mountains, you know, I'll give Virginia the mountains.
Republicans or Democrats, I'm not giving state lawmakers any credit for the beauty of our beaches. Or maybe very limited. North Carolina Friday News and Politics Roundup here on Due South, listener supported on WNC. Gary, there was a notable ruling from a federal judge that came down this week. The judge halted enforcement of a state law. It's a law that punishes people who are on probation or parole who cast a vote by accident. Who made this ruling and what was their rationale?
Well, it's very complicated. I'll try to get to the crux of it. So Judge Loretta Biggs, a federal judge in Winston-Salem, struck down a law that says that allowed prosecutors to go after people who were convicted felons who had not completed their terms of punishment. The law says that our state law says that you can't vote again and get your rights restored to vote until you complete your punishments if you've been convicted of a felony. And so she said that the law was discriminatory against African Americans that had vestiges in the Jim Crow era, and that also was constitutionally vague. Now, this law only applies retroactive to before January 1st because the legislature came in and adjusted the law to say that, no, you had to prove intentionality, that you knew the law, said that you could not vote if you were still a felon. And so they made it only deliberate, that you have to, you know, with intent to vote. And so, but that leaves a bunch of potential prosecutions of people who voted illegally through that method that's basically been thrown out unless the state decides to appeal the ruling.
Years ago, I spoke with a woman named Lanisha Bratcher, who had been a convicted felon, had gone to prison, had gotten out of prison, was still on parole, and she cast a ballot and was then, if memory serves, she was indicted for it, and she was facing potentially going back to prison.
That's
for casting a vote. which she claims, and I take her at her word, she didn't realize that that was against the rules. And one question I had, I remember in reporting that story, was, well, if it's against the rules, why was she even allowed to register to vote? Why wasn't she stopped on the front end? Why weren't other people stopped on the front end? And I don't expect you to have an answer for that, but I remember that being one thing where it's like, this doesn't quite
add up. To the intentionality point, I think you assume that if you go through the process, you give your name, they find you on the voter rolls, that you must be legitimately able to cast a vote, or they would, you know, send you on your way and say, sorry, you're not eligible. And so that's part of the reason for, I think, pushing on this issue. And the other issue is the fact that all this data out there is right. About voters.
Yeah.
So when you have really close elections, you have parties for the candidate or attorneys for the candidate who's behind by 10 votes looking for 10 people who cast votes who shouldn't have. And so some of this information gets dug up that maybe, you know, 20, 30 years ago wouldn't have come to light because the data wasn't so readily available and there weren't so many litigious parties trying right. To battle over those few votes in a close election.
Gary, is this settled? Is it heading to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals? Do we know yet?
We don't know yet. In this case, the legislative leaders were not the defendants. It was the State Board of Elections, as well as some local DAs that could or could not prosecute. So we don't know whether it's going to go to the Fourth Circuit. So, but the point is, going forward, there is that intentionality. But you have all these cases that might be out there pre-2024, regardless of intentionality. Right now, you know, they're voided and they're not going to go forward.
That's Gary Robertson. He's State House reporter at the Associated Press. Here with him in studio are Mary Helen Moore. She covers Durham for the News and Observer, Don Vaughn, Capitol Bureau Chief at the News and Observer, and Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief right here at WUNC. On the other side, we still need to check in on those canes. We're going to talk also about a nonprofit organization that has not done well and is folding up, and it has ties to one powerful and prominent politician. We'll tell you the details there in just a moment. More of our North Carolina News Roundup in just a bit. This is Due South on WUNC. Welcome back. It's the North Carolina Friday News Roundup on WUNC. The icon Dale Earnhardt would have turned 73 tomorrow. Kannapolis-born and North Carolina-bred, the legendary race car driver is among the greatest to ever patrol the track. Known as the Intimidator, Earnhardt claimed 76 checkered flags during his storied career and won 7 NASCAR Cup Series championships. That's tied for first all-time. He was the winner of the 1998 Daytona 500. Tragically, 3 years later, on the same track, Earnhardt was involved in a final lap crash. He suffered a fractured skull and was pronounced dead later that afternoon at a nearby hospital. Earnhardt was only 49 years old. His legacy remained significant almost immediately through major safety improvements to stock cars that were implemented in the wake of his death, then carrying on through his son, Dale Jr., a beloved figure in NASCAR. And to those of us who are not native to this state, and there are about 5 million of us now, I think it's worth noting and trying to understand just how monumental of a figure Dale Earnhardt remains in the annals of North Carolina. Anything to add on Dale before we jump back into news and sports? I've got sports here as well.
Dale is Dale. I mean, people can know what he looks like, and he was the Intimidator.
He's an institution. That number three is symbolic.
Yeah, I was thinking the number three. Anytime you see it, you're like, okay, that's the Dale number, whether you follow racing or not.
Don Vaughn, Gary Robertson, Mary Helen Moore, and Colin Campbell are here for our North Carolina News and Politics Roundup. Let's check in on the only major professional sports team here in the Triangle, Carolina's Hurricanes. Now lead the New York Islanders 3-0 in their best of 7 series. Last night in New York, the Canes won 3-2, got 2 assists from Andre Svechnikov and a second period goal from Sebastian Aho. I'm going to butcher these names at some point. I know I am. Carolina can close out the series tomorrow afternoon. Mary Helen Moore, you're a big Canes fan. Talk to us about game 2 when the Canes were down 3-0 early in the third period, and then they came back. This was crazy.
This was just an unbelievable game. I have seen it called this week the Category 5 game because they scored 5 straight unanswered goals.
I like it.
So, that's nice. And it was also historic, as my colleague found out. So at the end of the third period, they're down 2-3. They pull the goalie out of the net and manage to score. All right, so it's tied. We're going to overtime, right? That's what everyone thinks. somehow 9 seconds later, they score again. I mean, and it was just deafening. I was not there, but on TV, you can tell, and just absolute insanity inside PNC, which is like always lauded as one of the toughest road places to play on the road in the NHL. And then after they pulled their goalie to try and tie it up again, right, we scored in their empty net. And which my colleague found out is the first time that that has ever happened, where two teams score in the empty net.
Opposite empty netters late in a playoff game. Interesting. I did not realize that that was something that had happened. Has anybody been to a Canes game recently? Playoff game recently?
Not in recent years, but it's just amazing to me that she says that PNC Arena is one of the toughest road venues compared to what we heard for so many years that, oh, the North Carolina fans aren't going to be interested. They don't know what's going on. They're not passionate about it. And of course, they had some troubles with, filling the seats up. But now it is real. This is a hockey. This is a hockey town.
It helps when the team is good. I remember not that many years ago when you could go to a Canes game last minute, go on StubHub, get a ticket for like $7 or something. It was cheaper than a minor league game because nobody else wanted the tickets. Like, you're not going to get a $7 ticket to the Hurricanes anytime in the future, I don't think.
Yeah, they've made the playoffs 5 years straight. And I think for a lot of people, this feels like a really special year. I mean, they went into it with expectations they would be in the Stanley Cup Finals. They were the odds-on favorite when the playoffs started to win the Stanley Cup. And so,
I did go to, they had that Downtown Raleigh Canes Fest.
Yeah.
Was that about a year ago? That was fun. So maybe we'll get another one of those.
And I believe there's a watch party in Downtown Raleigh tomorrow. Game 4, Canes looking to sweep the Islanders. The real question, I think, as we think about the Eastern Conference, is can the Canes get by the Rangers? Can they handle the Rangers? Mary Helen's looking at me like, yeah, they can handle the Rangers.
we
shall see. Don, I want to spend a few minutes chatting about some reporting that you've done this week. It pertains to a nonprofit organization and its woes. Colin is going to chime in here as well, I suspect, because he also reported on it. Balanced Nutrition has been operated by Yolanda Hill. She's the wife of Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, of course, the presumptive Republican nominee for governor. The organization, Balanced Nutrition, has not properly tracked subsidized meals that it has provided to child care centers. The State Department of Health and Human Services is now looking into the nonprofit, and the nonprofit is shutting down. Do I have all that right?
Or less.
Okay. What else can you
add? DHHS will tell you, and I'm not the only one that's been writing about it. You all had, you've broken news, had good work on it. The Assembly did too. And this all started with the conservative website, the Daily Haymaker, last year. And we've all got records at different times. I've been looking into it for a while. But kind of the most recent development is sort of these exchange of emails between Hill's lawyer and DHHS. And DHHS says this is a standard review that we've done, and there's been some, or that we do. And there's been a lot of back and forth on the actual meeting with Balanced Nutrition. And DHHS said they were coming, and then Hill met them at the door and said, I'm not doing this without my lawyer. And DHHS wasn't happy about that, scheduled another time where their lawyer was there. And the push and pull here seems to be that Hill is like, I'm shutting it down. I'm done. This should be the end of it. And DHHS is like, well, not so fast. Like, we've got some other things that
is there a question of illegality here or that not necessarily?
I don't think anything is at that stage yet.
Okay. Yeah, but there's a lot we don't know. There's records that we're still trying to get from DHHS about the problems they've highlighted with this program. This is federal money we're talking about that's flowing through a state agency to these nonprofits that help child care centers get funding for their essentially meal program for the kids. There's a lot that seems like they may have violated some federal regulations in this. There's a lot of paperwork you have to do, record keeping. One of the things that I discovered was they don't have a balanced budget at some point in the last year. They were spending more than they were taking in. That was something HHS flagged them for. And a lot of what they were spending on was administrative costs that were over the level they were supposed to be, which that includes primarily Yolanda Hill's salary and the salary for some of the other Robinson family members who work for that. She had doubled her salary from, I think, $70,000 to $140,000 in a couple of years, all based on this state funding that this group was receiving. So there's some questions there. I mean, the big picture, the thing to zoom out about this group and its connection to the lieutenant governor is that Mark Robinson says in his autobiography that Yolanda Hill, his wife's success with this nonprofit, allowed him to quit his job at a furniture company right after his viral speech to the Greensboro City Council about gun rights and lay the groundwork for his run for lieutenant governor. So were it not for this group, which Mark Robinson was an employee of at one point, he may not have had the resources to be able to put together a successful campaign.
Well, the other thing, too, is that, you know, Republicans in this initial, I think a lot of people were looking into it for a while, but when it rises to the level of news coverage or anything else, but like within the conservative criticism is that, you know, Republicans don't like government programs, you know, other than.
And Mark Robinson talks
things,
about,
right.
you know, welfare and states and, you know, the federal government shouldn't be handing out money for various things, which a lot of conservatives say that would include a program where you get extra money for childcare center meals, when shouldn't that be covered by the tuition and the other funding sources that you have for, you know, childcare centers?
I can't help but think of some other times that Mark Robinson has been in the news for some fiscal missteps, those more personal, but thinking about taxes that were owed in Guilford County. Do we think that these issues are going to play out? Do we have any sense of how they might impact the campaign trail?
It doesn't seem to have done anything yet necessarily. I think a lot of voters this fall are looking for party over candidate. It might determine whether, I mean, it's the presidential race, so people, if they're going to come, they're coming for that probably. And then they might not check a box, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it could be a Trump-Stein is a possibility as far as like North Carolina voters. You know, they did it before with Trump Cooper. I mean, barely, you know, with Trump in the past. But I think it might, some Republicans may not like it with Robinson, but I don't know if it's going to swing.
Yeah,
and
I mean, for Democrats, they may be focused more on the various, you know, inflammatory things that Robinson has said, because those are sort of easy to play back in a 30-second TV ad on ways that this is, as you can tell from this conversation, is a lot more complicated to explain.
Right.
But it does speak to this issue of, is this guy ready to handle, you know, oversight of multiple big government agencies, and as we talked about earlier in the show, come up with the state budget plan, even if it's not the plan that's final, it's still part of the job.
Big process. Colin Campbell, Gary Robertson, Don Vaughn here on the North Carolina Friday News Roundup. So too is Mary Helen Moore. And Mary Helen, I want to turn to you in our final couple of moments. You had a story this week. The headline reads, Downtown Durham has five restaurants that have remained open for 20 years. Can you name them? My answer is, I don't think so, but I'm going to give you a guess and see if I can hit any of them.
Okay.
Bull McCabe's, The Federal, Luna, Mother and Sons, Parker and Otis.
You got one.
I thought you said I got five.
And it's probably not the one you expect. You got The Federal, which turned 20 years old this week.
Oh, I did not see that anything on social media. I love The Federal. I want to hear
I want to hear what Don says.
Because I'm thinking now, since
Don worked for the Herald Sun for a long time.
I know. I was like, did I work here 20 years ago? I'm thinking of like all the longtime restaurants that ended up shutting down, right? Didn't like Elmo's Diner shut down? 9th Street Bakery
downtown.
Has been open.
Downtown.
Oh, only downtown. I'm going to say 9th Street Bakery because it used to be on 9th Street and then moved into the historic Herald Sun building downtown.
That's
and
a good
one. I feel like that's been around for a really long time. Parker Notice at Brightleaf. I don't know if they've hit 20 years.
They clearly have
so
not.
I don't think so. Definitely not Luna. Definitely not like, I mean, I remember when they all, when they all started.
What's that little like sandwich stand over near?
Oh, Kings.
Kings.
Yes. By the old ballpark.
These are wonderful guesses. 9th Street Bakery is correct. They're number two. They started in 1981, moved downtown in 92. So they're solidly in there. Kinks is what everybody thought it was going to be, but it's wrong because they closed for a few years when they opened in 1942.
Wow.
But they reopened in the same building.
But in 2010.
Doesn't count by
So what are the other
Number
three?
One is Divine's. Divine's has been around since 1978.
Yeah, okay.
Duke Blue Devil Sports Bar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've never eaten there either, but...
I have, actually.
And then the other two that you missed from the top five are JC's Kitchen, which is at the top of Fayetteville Street
of course,
in Haytai. And then James Joyce, the Federal's next-door neighbor.
I when I was tapping this out a couple hours ago at my desk, I thought of Joyce, but I didn't put it down. So I don't get credit for that. I'm whining there. Mary Helen, one quick follow-up here. Briefly, and it's probably not a brief answer, but why are there only five restaurants that have been open for 20 years in downtown Durham?
Surviving in downtown is hard, and it was hard during COVID, but it was hard before that. And downtown's residential population is growing right now, but the office population has shrunk since COVID. So it's hard.
Mary Helen Moore covers Durham for the News and Observer. She's been part of our North Carolina Friday News and Politics Roundtable, along with Gary Robertson, State House reporter, Associated Press, Don Vaughn, Capitol Bureau Chief at the News and Observer, and Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief right here at WUNC. Thanks, y'all. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
On the way out today, a thank you. We are in the midst of a pledge drive after all. Thank you for listening, returning, engaging with us, sharing your wants, curiosity, questions, critiques, and joining us as we embark on this daily show journey. Without you, our loyal, generous, eagle-eared listener, we'd be in deep you-know-what. So thanks for your support and your belief in us. And a request as we part ways until Monday. No, it's not a solicitation. Do me a favor, please, share this episode with someone. Pass it along to somebody that you love or work with or live near. Somebody who sees the world as you do, or if you really want to make me happy, somebody who might not agree with you all the time or even much of the time. We're building this Due South thing, and we're building an audience, and we want to grow that audience. So please, if you would, pass along a link to someone in your orbit. That goes for you too, Mom and Dad. They listen all the time. Thanks again for tuning in. This is Due South on WUNC.